The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
One of the challenges is that space is really big, and so, you know, to be able to travel even within our solar system is very challenging, and outside of our solar system is essentially like impossible within a human lifetime. And so, you know, for like crafts to show up here, one thing that we'd be assured of essentially is that they'd be from outside the solar system, otherwise we would have actually detected them already, which means that they have solved like a major challenge in propulsion. Which probably also means that they've solved a bunch of energy challenges too, right? Because you don't like spend a whole lot of your resources going out into space unless you have some idea of how to generate energy efficiently and to do it in like a totally different or at least much more clever way than we do. And so, you know, I would want to know all of those questions about like, hey, what are you doing here? But also like, how did you get here? How does that car work? can I drive it?
I'm Shane Harris, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 31st, 2018. For years, I've been fascinated by the search for extraterrestrial life in the universe. But that search raises a profound question. Should we try to communicate with aliens? Is there a risk of alerting a potentially hostile species to our presence? On July 12th, I moderated a conversation with Lucianne Walkowitz, the chair of astrobiology at the Library of Congress, and NASA astrophysicist Elisa Quintana. We talked about the ethics of the search for ETs and the associated risks with trying to make contact. It's a wide-ranging discussion that will appeal even to those sad non-believers among you. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 334, Should Humans Communicate with Aliens?
Let's dig in, and I want to sort of posit or maybe even provoke something at the outset to kind of start laying the groundwork for what we're going to explore about whether we should be communicating with aliens, and sort of suggest that we seem to kind of be communicating with aliens now in the following respects, and you'll correct me if I'm off on this and tell me what are we really doing to communicate with them. So 40 years ago, NASA launched the Voyager probes, right, to go out and explore the outer reaches of the solar system and the major big planets at the edge of the solar system. But as many people probably know, there were two gold records that were fitted on each of those probes called the Sounds of Earth, which were basically roadmaps to where we are, greetings from the people of Earth in many different languages, essentially putting on this probe a recording such that if it were ever discovered, somebody who would know who we are and where this came from. I think that's kind of a form of communication. The chances of that galactic message in a bottle actually being discovered are probably pretty low. You'll tell me like infinitesimally low and like shatter all my dreams. But that's, I think, a form of communication. And then of course we have SETI, which is the organization that does the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, which is out there listening, right, for radio waves and transmissions that might be coming in to us. If you saw the movie Contact, right, it's Jodie Foster out there with the big radar listening for if anybody is out there. So am I right that we are sort of communicating with aliens now, or trying to communicate with them? And what exactly does the playing field look like if we think about, you know, what those assets are that are out there and what those efforts are that are out there?
Yeah, so we are and we aren't. So first of all, about those golden records. So let's get the soul crushing over with first.
Don't do, oh, God. Right.
So it is true that we had these like wonderful golden records. You can actually go and listen to some of those sounds online. The sound files are up there. And I think they actually did like a repress of the golden record in the past couple of years. And it's true also that the Voyager spacecraft has essentially left the solar system. But to put this in perspective, it's a little, first of all, they're some of the fastest things we've ever made, something like 31,000 miles per hour or so. And they've just left the solar system after about 30 years of traveling or so. So this is a little bit like if you like wrote a message in a bottle and you were like, this is it, I'm going to communicate with aliens. And then you threw it across your living room. And you're like, I'm done.
Someone's going to find this.
I can't wait to hear back. So, you know, having said that, we have also sent like radio signals out into the universe, and we've also sent optical signals, so visible light as well. So one of the other aspects of SETI, or the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, are these optical beams that some astronomers look for, but that we actually accidentally send out because we use lasers when we observe stars and we want to get really high resolution. It actually helps us correct for the jiggliness of the image through the atmosphere of our own planet because we're looking through this thick layer of air. So we actually send like laser beams out into space all the time. But as far as like radio signals go, we're getting quieter and quieter because our technology is getting better. So as we become more advanced, we're actually kind of harder to find.
Okay. Yeah. Lisa?
I think what they put on those records are beautiful, but I've heard a lot of other feedback that they're so not representative of Earth. And I think they gave it a good try. They wanted to show, you know, somebody that got them, like, what Earth is like. And I don't know if anyone went to the opening at the symphony here when they had the NASA night, but Carl Sagan's son was there, and he said his voice was... He was representing all the little kids around the world, and it was really heartwarming, and it's amazing what they put on it. But then they were basically four people in a room that decided what to put on these records. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think there's anything about like what the world is really like. But I agree. We've done little things, but in the grand scheme of things, like space is big, and time is long. And so we have a ways to go.
So it sounds like we're sort of, roughly speaking, we're very much in a listen mode, not a talking mode when it comes to attempting to form some communication with an outside force, yeah?
Yeah, I would say that, Elisa, you just touched on something that I think has been a topic of debate in the past couple of years, which is, you know, we have in the past sent signals out into space to try and, you know, signal some other intelligence that might be out there. And recently, I know that there are groups, there's one named SETI International, so SETI, SETI is Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, SETI is Messaging Extraterrestrial Intelligence. So there are groups that want to get together and make a concerted effort to send messages out there again. But it's the same thing with the Golden Record, where it's like, okay, so... this has potentially global consequences, and like these 20 people are like, I feel qualified to speak for Earth. you know, with all due respect to their various qualifications, you know, one of the things that has been a topic of debate has been, you know, who actually should decide what we say.
Yeah, so we have, well, we, there is a protocol for what we should do if we get some signals. You know, we're right now sort of eavesdropping, and there's this formality, what happens if we were to get a signal. And we're still trying to figure out what to do as far as sending a signal. And there's a lot of controversy over that, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But there isn't any protocol right now, at least as far as I know, because it's such a controversial topic. And yeah, so we can talk.
Yeah,
about
okay, so let's start digging into that controversy then, which is kind of what the meat of this discussion is about. So what are the arguments whatever four of those are put forth in, for and against blasting out into space? Here's who we are, here's how to find us, pick up the phone, let's talk. What's the pro and the con for that at a broad level? We're going to get into the micro.
Well, this isn't my opinion, but people are afraid of revealing themselves and being vulnerable to other civilizations that might identify us and say, let's go get them, basically. And there's a lot of this Hollywood thought that, like, why should we reveal ourselves? There's lots of pros, exploration, trying to, you know, grow as a human species and learn more. If we do, you know, eventually get to interact with other species, maybe we can learn more about, I don't know, saving our own planet.
Yeah, I think, you know, the pros are kind of hard to quantify because, you know, on the one hand, like anybody who, you know, might sort of pick up the interstellar telephone might be significantly more advanced than we are. And that could be a good thing or a bad thing. You know, it could be something where, you know, they've solved a bunch of these like really nasty problems that we have facing us here, these existential problems. And maybe, you know, we could learn something, you know, as much as it also would be incredibly interesting to just learn whether, you know, other, you know, life with the kinds of motivations that we have and like technology that would be even wanting to send that signal, that would be an interesting thing to know. But they might also be able to advise us, or they might see us the way, you know, that we treat a lot of animals here on Earth, where we might be like, they're essentially food. And I, you know,
or pets.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of the objections to sending those sorts of messages at all are folks who are like, you know, no way anybody who might actually pick up and come here. We would be advertising that we have, you know, at least a sort of base level of subsistence, that we can do things like try to send messages out into space, which means we have resources to spare. So it might be a motivation for somebody to come and get us.
On a practical level, when we talk about how we're blasting these things out, just so people have a sense, is it, I mean, messages that are being beamed out via the same kinds of devices that we're using to listen to the signals coming back? And people who are doing METI, I mean, are they podcasting into space? Like, what are those, what's the routine look like?
I'm not really sure that there is a routine. I mean, often it is the same kinds of infrastructure, you know, like radio dishes or optical telescopes. I don't know if anybody podcasting into space.
No, I don't either.
Not intentionally, anyway.
I mean, I think we're sending things out naturally just through like radar and, I don't know, radio and things. But those are all relatively weak. Compared to anything. But.
Are we, in the same way that we're listening for radio waves emanating from, you know, other planetary sources, are we just on a day-to-day basis just giving off our own signals such that we don't even have to intentionally be trying to put the bottle out there into the galaxy? It's just we're throwing stuff off all the time that might get picked up?
Yes and no. I mean, it is really weak. That stuff, if you're not really putting a lot of energy into it and really like intentionally sending it in a concentrated way out into space, our signal is relatively, we're kind of quiet. But it also, you know, now that like we don't send TV signals in the same way, like a lot of things are transmitted through fiber optic cable, for example. So we get quieter with time. Actually, the better we get at technology, the harder we are to detect as a technologically advanced species.
So does that presume, for folks who are at SETI, does that mean that the signals that we're listening to, if they are powerful enough to reach us, do we then presume they're coming from some species that wants us to hear it?
That's a good question, and I think maybe we don't know. I don't know. I know that when we can talk about the Kepler. So the Kepler mission was a mission that was designed specifically to search for planets orbiting other stars, and specifically small planets. It's been wildly successful. They found thousands of small planets, and the first thing SETI did was point their radio telescopes at all of those, and has been listening. And so, I mean, it's a real science, and they're listening. But as far as broadcasting, I think that's what the METI is for. I think their organization is to really do it in a strong way, and not just a passive way. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I also I think we should distinguish too between the SETI Institute and SETI as an enterprise. Mm-hmm. So the SETI Institute is an astrobiology institute in the Bay Area that was founded by Jill Tarter, who is the actual person that Jodie Foster is playing in the movie Contact, is a real woman. And you know, they have really led the way on a lot of that sort of passive listening that has happened over the years, but the broader envelope of SETI, that is just anything that looks for extraterrestrial intelligence, actually encompasses a lot of different things. So, you know, for example, there are folks like myself that have used the Kepler data to look for any kind of optical or visible light signals that might be really unusual. And there was even a really unusual star that was observed, which is still, you know, not completely a solved case, but that there was an argument in like the published literature about whether it was maybe some like large scale alien engineering, you know, and to your question on like whether that's intentional or not, okay, sure, it could be. Like you could actually build something that orbits your star and it blocks the light from time to time. Or maybe you were just like, well, how do I harness more light from this star? And you do it, and then it turns out that you have created something that, you know, Elisa sees. And it's like, the aliens.
This means something.
And I guess just to take a step back, the way I see the search for life in the universe is typically in three different ways. There's searching within our own solar system, and that we're most likely not going to find intelligent life, like people like us on the moons or other planets, but there could be lots of other types of life, microbial life. There's exoplanets, and that's searching for planets orbiting distant stars, looking to see if they have atmospheres, looking to see if their atmospheres have any signals of life. And there's the classical SETI that is listening for engineered signals. And so the SETI Institute includes the classical SETI and a huge number of astrobiologists that do this amazing wide range of science and everything from anything that has to do with life in the universe. And so they have scientists that go to the driest deserts in Chile and see if life can survive. Or we have divers that go, you know, to these crazy ocean vents, and I don't know how they do it. They go to crazy, or to some toxic places in the south side of Chicago, I've heard is a good place to find some crazy signs of life. Just basically extreme life. And so there's a ton of science with the SETI Institute, in addition to this classical SETI, all with the same goal of trying to find if life exists and what's the next step.
I would like it noted that life is thriving on the south side of Chicago.
You can represent. All right, so let's step off the realm of science and a little more into the realm of science fiction now and imagine some things. So I want to present two what I think are plausible scenarios of contact anyway, but even if they're not, just go with it. Okay. All right, there are two ways that we're contacted. One is we detect a radio wave from a very far away galaxy, and there is no physical contact between us and an alien life form. There is merely the signal that we've received, and God knows how many thousands of years old it might be. It might be from a civilization long dead. And the second is the ships show up and are hovering over our cities, right? Okay. Our response is going to be very different to each of those scenarios. So let's play it out a little bit. How do we respond, or do you all imagine we respond, if it's a maybe a contact style situation, right? Where suddenly the frequency is detected, there is something that cannot be explained by anything in the near solar system. We skip ahead through the science, we're pretty sure we've been contacted by some other intelligent form. I guess, A, how would we determine whether it's intelligent or not just some sort of, you know, other kind of signal? But then, so how does the response to that start to unfold? Particularly because they're not here, they're out there someplace.
Yeah, I guess I could speak to a little bit about how we might try to figure out whether it was an intelligent signal, intelligent or, you know, engineered signal, I think is a good way of putting it. You know, one of the active areas of research and is very active actually at the SETI Institute, there's a man there named Lawrence Doyle who works on studying animal communication, actually. And one of the big debates for SETI as a whole enterprise, not just the Institute, over the years has been, how do you figure out what some other life form might decide to send into space? And there's arguments that, you know, you might choose something that represents like the physics and chemistry that we know about, or that, like, you know, represents knowledge of higher math. A lot of times what that breaks down into, at least from animal communication, is the amount of structure in the language. So there's this whole theory of information where you can quantify basically what kind of distribution of structure a language should have. So in, you know, the English language, for example, that would break down into like letters, or you could think of it as being individual sounds, and you could look at the frequency of with which like certain letters are used versus others, and it would give you some way of actually quantifying like the mathematical structures that are in there. So, you know, for example, this talk would hopefully have some structure. A baby babbling, you know, a baby babbling, the sounds kind of come out at random, right? So you wouldn't necessarily see a lot of structure there. So that's one way of detecting whether something is engineered, mm-hmm. even if you don't know what it is or what it means. And so a lot of Doyle's work studies whales, because we can't communicate with whales, but we know that they essentially are able to communicate with each other. But then what happens? I'm not sure about. And then we really get into the debate about METI.
Yeah, speaking of ocean animals, I've been like really fascinated with octopi and cephalopods.
So like octopuses.
Yeah. So a few years ago, there was a story that came out. The dolphin reminded me of it. Of Inky, this octopus that had snuck out of his aquarium in New Zealand. And they figured out that he waited for the right time when people left, and he opened up like his little aquarium and snuck out, and they saw like the water path, and he snuck down into this tube that went out into the ocean. And he was like smart enough to know when everyone left and when he could actually escape. And I don't know, just the story of Inky like made me laugh so hard because everyone was so serious about like, so Inky's gone. And so then myself and one of my colleagues started reading a lot about this intelligence, and it's really amazing. And like, how more alien can you be than an octopus? And so there's a lot of research with that. There's a lot of research with dolphin communication. And I guess one of the things to think about is like, if we are contacted and we're trying to figure out how to communicate, there's lots of examples here on Earth where there are a lot of things that we don't know how to communicate with. And so what do we do with that?
So if we get, just kind of play this out, how this might work as a process, right? So the signal comes in. I mean, one question I have is like, when do the people who receive the signal tell the world that they've received it? And is there a whole ethical consideration around that? Like, is it responsible to, you know, call me at the Washington Post or tweet it out or something? Or do you really keep that to yourself and try to start understanding what you're dealing with? I mean, I would imagine that's kind of maybe part of the step one, right? Is do we even tell anyone? And do we want to verify this first?
Yeah, there's definitely a protocol. Like SETI is very adamant about knowing that the government isn't going to hide if we find aliens. There is a protocol that follows a scientific process. I guess if you think about past claims, there was sometime in the 90s, there was a person that found a Martian meteorite and thought that there were some microorganism features in there. And President Bill Clinton came out and gave this big speech to America before they realized that maybe it's not necessarily, you know, life. It could be a lot of other things. So I think if we did find out that somebody contacted us, I don't think anyone could keep that a secret. And I think that people try to have some order. Hopefully there would be some order and they would follow this process.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think about, right? Because I think it also comes down to like who, what is the actual situation that happens? Like, you know, if you are an astronomer that takes data and analyzes it, whether you're looking for aliens or otherwise, like a lot of our job looks like us sitting at a laptop. Like that's what it looks like. You're sitting at a desk, you know, you're analyzing your data, you're thinking about things. Probably the first thing that happens is that you would, you know, if you however the magic happens, you like magically decode this thing, right? You're like, oh my God, aliens. And you'd probably be like, well, that can't be right. So then there'd be like another 2 days where you like look for the bug in your code. and then you'd probably end up sharing with like some colleagues and being like, what do we do with this? And from there, you know, I think that's where kind of the unguessableness of human nature comes into play. You know, I think because this is such a loaded topic and it's something that really like grabs people's imaginations, most scientists who work on this subject are very cautious about making announcements like that. And that's why we like publish things in peer-reviewed literature, And then, you know, there might be press releases, but generally speaking, they happen afterwards. However, people tweet all kinds of things these days, so you never know.
So it seems like, and I imagine that there's this obviously this period of debate, and then maybe even the public gets hold of it, and people are questioning whether it's real or it's not. But at some point, the question starts to, I guess, like, two big questions come into play. A, what are they saying? And B, how are we supposed to respond to that? As a first order question, is there something you look for in the language that tells you that whatever the signal is actually a question versus just, you know, some alien sitcom that got beamed out and is now passing by 60,000 years later? Do we try to say, okay, hold on, what are they asking us something? Because it seems like maybe it's just our human arrogance, but I would imagine just embedded in all of this is, well, what are we going to do about this, right? It must mean something.
I mean, that's when you get back to whales, right? Like, what questions are dolphins are probably on the regular being like, why am I in this tank? Why am I in this tank? Right?
Do we play the tape for the dolphin?
Yeah, maybe. There's an old Far Side comic where the scientists are writing "Yo habla español" on the thing next to the dolphin tank, right? So, I think that it's relatively straightforward to use information theory to say that something has structure and is probably a language. It is much more difficult to know what it is saying.
Yeah, and just before we started, we were talking about the movie Arrival, and I think probably one of the things we would do is just get all the specialists around and try to figure out what to do, because I don't know if anyone is prepared for that.
What if, I mean, now I'm just imagining this because this is fun for me. So what if it's in binary and it literally is something we can just decode it like that and it says, hi, here's where we are. Here's our names. Who are you? I mean, do we just freak out? Do we stay quiet? Now, this is really the dilemma, right? It's like it's an actual question. You know, like they don't have they can't see that it's red, I guess, like you can on your text message. But what happens then? I mean, this is really sort of where we get down to brass tacks, right?
But I think it's still, like, all of this is still this, like Lucianne said, this very active area of research and conversation, because it's one thing to listen, and then it's another thing to reach out or to respond. And there have been lots of conferences, lots of SETI people, and METI people. I don't know if anyone's heard of WETI.
Do you WETI?
Follow WETI?
Weather?
If you follow WETI, I shouldn't advertise this. If you follow WETI on Twitter, it's Waiting for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and all their tweets are basically saying, still waiting, and they're just waiting. it's actually kind of funny.
That sounds terrible.
There's lots of conferences, a huge community trying to figure out this answer, trying to figure out what do we need to do to get a global consensus on how to proceed. And I think it's not easy because there's a lot of opinions, and as far as I know, there hasn't been much progress made on that front.
Yeah, I think one of the real challenges with something like sending messages out into space is that given access to, you know, appropriate equipment, where appropriate equipment is just like, I don't know, any kind of radio dish that's powerful enough, or maybe like a laser and a telescope. So, you know, not like stuff that you have in your kitchen, but things that exist in the world. Like, you don't have to invent a new kind of rocket to do this, right? So one of the challenges is that it is actually possible for like a few people to take unilateral action. And so, you know, I think that one of the real challenges here is the fact that there isn't really a globally defined, like, here is what we're all going to do and we've all agreed on it. It is still possible for people to decide that they're going to do something else.
And do we also just assume that if the radio signal, let's say it's a radio signal, got here, that it could just have emanated so long ago that the possibility of a reply just isn't feasible? I mean, if it took 50,000 years to get here, it's going to take 50,000 years to get it back, right?
Well, you can still reply.
Yeah, right.
You know, like, right. Like people that have ever emailed me know, it's never too late.
Well, that sort of presents a whole new ethical dilemma too, right? Because now we're taking some action that's going to affect human beings 50,000 years from now when they get it back. I'm like, oh God, they wrote back. All right. Well, let's take scenario two, which is a more immediate kind of scenario, so that we don't have to ponder the ethics of it. They're here, right? They're. It's like arrival. There's 13 crafts, and they're hovering over places, and we don't know what the hell they're here for. What's the first thing that we do? I mean, is the first thing you do is try to communicate with it, or is that a bad idea? Because they're going to call you. The helicopter is going to be landing in your house in Chicago, and you're coming with us.
I mean, for me, I'm a scientist, so I'm curious, and I have no problem trying to, I don't know, I have no problem supporting people that want to reach out and explore. I would just want to figure out how to communicate and learn where are they from and how can they help us? And are they a threat? Probably not, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I would want to know how they got here, uh-huh. right? Because yeah. one of the challenges, as you touched on, we didn't explicitly say so, but one of the challenges is that space is really big. And so, to be able to travel even within our solar system is very challenging, and outside of our solar system is essentially like impossible within a human lifetime. And so, for like crafts to show up here, one thing that we'd be assured of essentially is that they'd be from outside the solar system. Otherwise, we would have actually detected them already, which means that they have solved like a major challenge in propulsion. Which probably also means that they've solved a bunch of energy challenges too, right? Because you don't like spend a whole lot of your resources going out into space unless you have some idea of how to generate energy efficiently and to do it in like a totally different or at least much more clever way than we do. And so, I would want to know all of those questions about like, yeah. Hey, what are you doing here? But also like, how did you get here? How does that car work? can I drive it?
Yeah, I have a lot of friends. I'm personally not a Trekkie, but I have tons of friends that watch Star Trek, and they're like, God, why can't our lives ever be like that? We'll never know what that's like. Like, that'll never happen because, I mean, the nearest star to us is Proxima Centauri, and it's still 4 light years away. And we don't have the technology to go there just yet. But to actually travel to other planets, like, that's just, it's pure science fiction. And so having someone here would, give people hope that maybe that is something that we could do. And that's a good point. Like, I would want to know how they got here too.
So if the craft arrives and it's not overtly communicating with us, we don't know how to speak its language, we don't necessarily know the risks that we might incur by provoking it into some conversation, is the smarter play to actually just study the hell out of it and scan it and just try and detect as much as we possibly can about its propulsion, its machinery, without even trying to engage them first? I mean, I could imagine a whole slew of things that we could do short of picking up the phone, so to speak.
I mean, I would argue that, once somebody is like parked their car in your garage, like that's a message.
It is a form of communication.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. I also I was thinking as you were talking about like what happens if you see like a really souped up car on the street and you go poking around it, like, whoever owns it is not far away, right?
Yeah.
I think that it would always be the smart thing to try and study it. I mean, we're both scientists, so.
Right now I was just thinking about the movie E.T., where I would say, well, you'd still want to respect it because maybe it doesn't want to be like prodded. And I wouldn't want like the whole government to take control and treat it as a lab specimen and go the Hollywood route, but at the same time, that's such a huge thing. Like, you would want to know how it got there and what is it. Well, tough question.
Right. Well, I think it's why Arrival is such an interesting movie for those who haven't seen it. But, like, they don't make their intentions known immediately. And it's a struggle to figure out what they want, right? I mean, it strikes me that that's a plausible scenario, right? Is that there's going to be some effort involved on our part for figuring this out. We shouldn't necessarily... Well, this is a good question. Should we assume if they have the technology to move across space and time to actually get here, that communicating with us would be a trivial matter? Or is there something about communication separate from engineering that makes that an entirely different problem? And maybe they, show up here after having zipped across, light years, but they just don't know how to talk to us.
No, that's a great question. Yeah, I was thinking about it earlier. A lot of people ask, like, why haven't we been detected already, this and that? And I have lots of, things to say about it. But if something is advanced enough, something can actually get here to us, then they must have a lot more knowledge than we do, and they must know a lot more than we do. And that's a really interesting question. Like, how do we know that it's not just engineering and they accidentally crashed into our planet versus right. like they know what they're doing?
Right. They took a wrong turn at Albuquerque.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, back to the whales, right? Like, we can send James Cameron to the bottom of the ocean, but we cannot make James Cameron talk to dolphins, at least not in a way that dolphins can talk back and he can understand.
Right. That. Right. Okay, so I have a set of questions that I like to put under the category of what's the worst that could happen? Let's assume we're going in this very, like, kind of aggressive forward, you know, contact them kind of way. Do we assume that an alien species who shows up here automatically has our best interest in mind or is here to subjugate us?
I don't think we should make any assumptions about an alien species that arrives, except for the fact that they have at least figured out something very significant about propulsion and
yes.
space travel.
Yeah, we agree on that.
Yeah, the evidence is there for that. But I don't think that you necessarily, you know, get any benefit from assuming that they're there to subjugate you or there to, you know, like because they crashed or anything. I think you want to try and learn.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so, I mean, Stephen Hawking made a splash before he passed that he thinks we should not go telling people where we are because it's dangerous. And so that's an interesting perspective because you basically assume that they are just like us and they know. Essentially, you're assuming that there are other intelligent species that are predatory that, I mean, we have no idea, basically. Like, we have no idea about anything. And if we saw something, we have no idea because, like, the whole solar system is diverse. All the planets we see are diverse. Things evolve differently. What are the chances that there's going to be another planet that where life evolves just like us that decides to come over here and conquer us? Like, it's just kind of this crazy idea, in my opinion.
Let me ask a question on this. So, why shouldn't we presume that that's exactly what they want to do, right? So, this an alien craft arrives, having clearly knowledge of propulsion that is, you know, maybe not beyond our comprehension, but is vastly beyond our capability. They show up here. They can take one look at us and realize that we're effectively primitive in that respect. Why shouldn't we believe that they're basically just here to deal with us the way we would deal with, you know, chickens if we found them? Like, oh, they're food. Let's lock them up or let's experiment with them. I mean, what could they possibly want with us other than very bad things?
I guess I would say that you kind of don't lose anything by keeping your mind open. Like, if an alien civilization that is capable of getting all the way across the galaxy gets here and wants to subjugate you,
yeah,
probably they're not going to have a problem no matter what
happen.
You think yeah. about their motivations.
Just get used to the idea.
So you might as well try to figure out why they're here.
Yeah.
Why are you subjugating me like this?
Yeah.
No, that's a perfect point. Like, if they have the capability to come land here, I'm sure they have the capability to wipe us out if we wanted to, I would imagine.
Yeah,
and I'm going back to Hollywood.
Well, sure. And I think that the opportunity for learning from them is so significant. Like, what is the version of contact where you decide that they're definitely here to subjugate you and you blow them up and then you, like, never learn about space travel? Like, that seems like giving up a really big prize. Or you never learn how to solve all of the diseases we face. You know, we don't know anything. We literally know nothing about this in this, like, fictional scenario. So, you know, we don't even know if their biology would be anything different. Who knows? Maybe what they've solved is not propulsion, but mortality.
Hmm.
Like, maybe they've just been traveling a really long time.
For a really long time.
Yeah.
Do you think if they show up, is it worth keeping an open mind, but essentially bringing out the big stick, right? So, okay, you have this very powerful propulsion you've been able to get here. We also have an arsenal of weapons that can incinerate the rock that you're sitting on right now. Is it worth basically saying to them, okay, we want to talk, but don't make any funny moves because we can do things to you too? Just to, you know, it's just, I mean, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, militaries go through this all the time, right? As part of doctrine of, like, demonstration of force. I mean, there's an entire you know, there are people, you know, are trained on this in our militaries of ways that we signal to each other, like, I'm not going to shoot at you, but understand that if you cross this line, we're going to have a problem. It's signaling. It's how, is there a worthwhile, practical demonstration of force that you make short of, you know, obviously, you know, firing off the missiles at the craft?
So I think this is a reason that SETI wants to make an effort to have a global agreement on how to respond. So we don't have loose cannons saying, you know, what are you doing here? I think it's a valid thing to do to try to figure out now, answer these questions, like, what would we do? And I mean, personally, I wouldn't respond like that. But SETI basically has this philosophy that we want to represent humankind communicating outside of the solar system and towards us. And so I think it's this global sort of community that needs to agree on what to do. And so maybe that's not answering your question, but I think it's something that people need to agree on and not just take this like army action that, you know, we have bigger guns or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, because also what makes you think that like our weapons would be interpretable as weapons?
Oh, that's interesting.
Like, they've figured out intergalactic travel.
Right.
You know, we might bring out our like biggest weapon and they'll be like, is it food? Like, what is
Why aren't you eating that? That looks delicious.
Yeah. I mean, there's no reason to think that any kind of like show of force would actually be interpretable as a show of force or any like, you know, with, you ever tried to get a cat to do what you want it to do?
Yes, like, every day.
Be like, don't get on the couch, you know? Like, you can draw all the lines in the sand that you want, but if you don't have any kind of viable communication, it's not necessarily going to be interpreted or even paid attention to.
You know, it strikes me that kind of going back to the beginning of our conversation, while it was Carl Sagan and a few dudes in a room, there is a production, right? Of there is a method of communication that we've put down on tape, so to speak. It's the golden record, right? So what's the harm in when they show up? I mean, it strikes me that if we thought that putting that on the Voyager probe and sending out the message in a bottle wasn't such a bad idea, why not when they show up just start playing the record? I mean, it kind of encapsulates everything we want to say about ourselves as, granted, decided by this small group of people, but it does it in a remarkably efficient way. It's basically, it's 90 minutes and all of what we could squeeze in of human language and culture right there on the disc.
But it depends so much on what they are. I mean, something will show up, and if it's in human form and they're talking, or even in alien form and you have some communication, then, oh yeah, maybe give them the record. But like, it could be something that we don't even recognize, or it could be something like, how would we know?
How do you know they hear sound at the same frequency as we do?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, like, also, I mean, like, the golden record is not representative of all of humanity. It has this, like, weird, naked, heteronormative couple on it, and, like,
Which was controversial, by the way, when it was launched, because they were naked.
Yeah.
That was the
people
problem.
People were like, this is pornographic, and you're sending it
porn
to the
porn in space.
I'm not even kidding. you know, I always think of, I really love the movie Mars Attacks. And if you haven't seen it, there's this amazing moment where like the Martians come down and they like release a dove into the sky, and it's interpreted as a sign of war, and they blast it out of the sky, and that is what creates the invasion.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, it's the interesting thing was putting the golden record on Voyager in the first place just kind of a dumb idea? Does it say more about our ambitions and hopes than it does about any actual practical hope of communicating with another life form?
Oh yeah.
It's really about it's about us, not them, right?
Like, I don't even think there's a record player on the
there's not really. They're supposed like, to get sure it and be like, oh that, guys, it's a record. Here, put it on.
It's definitely a sign of the times, that's for sure.
So now I want to get like really creepy. So we kind of alluded at this and danced around it a little bit. But one big question I think a lot of people have is, have we already been contacted? And I want to know what, I want to keep this on the level of science as much as possible. But what do people in the SETI community, if I can put it that way, think about the possibility that we may have already been contacted? How do you start to grapple with, you know, look, UFO sightings, for instance, or or the possibility that, like, it doesn't seem that crazy to think that if a craft can appear here after traveling for across light years of space, that it might also have the ability to be stealth and just kind of hang out and watch us and we don't see it.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if we have already been contacted, but we have no way of knowing. So one of the biggest, I don't want to say complaints, well, studying exoplanets is, you know, we try to find other planets that are just like Earth, and that's because we know Earth has life. And people say, well, why are you so egotistical and why are you trying to find an Earth? And people ask Jill Tarter all the time, why are you trying to find, you know, life that has water? Because we know life is a necessary ingredient for life. And her answer is because that's all we know. Like, we know what is required to have life and to have life evolve. And that's all we can look for. Like, we don't know what to look for. And you have done research on this, so you can comment more. But and it's the same thing. If we have been contacted, like, how will we know? And the people at SETI aren't dumb. Like, they do keep an open mind. They're not egotistical. But you have to start from somewhere. And we know that a planet the size of Earth that, you know, is in a temperate zone that has water could be a place for extraterrestrial life. That's kind of the minimum that we look for. But we have no idea. I mean, Titan is covered in methane, and Europa is covered in ice, and there's extreme environments on Earth. And we all agree that life could be everywhere, and we all agree that we just don't know how can we identify it? And so I think it's impossible to answer that question.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I guess, there definitely is this element of like the practical aspect of looking for life is that, you know, a lot of times we look for these Earth-like planets or we look for things like radio signals because we are occupants of an Earth-like planet that makes radio signals. And it's just literally just a like practical consideration of, you know, given that distances are so very great at space and that we do a lot of like remote sensing, you know, in the same way that we observe our own planet with satellites, you know, here we can take actual like images of the planet and see all these wonderful detailed things, but we literally cannot see planets around other stars. They are so outshone by the stars themselves that we don't get the kinds of images that we do for this planet. And even looking at this planet, it's kind of hard to tell that life is there if you're just like looking at a daytime image of Earth. So, you know, I think that there's this practical consideration of like what you would look for. I was actually thinking a little bit about this question this morning, in part because every time you guys tweeted this event, my mentions on Twitter just like filled with people's opinions about aliens. It's like, oh, good. Here's that subscription to Mansplaining Monthly I was hoping for. I just can't seem to unsubscribe.
You were searching for intelligent life.
But, you know, I was thinking about it. And, you know, first of all, like UFO, right, stands for something specific. It stands for unidentified flying object. It just means thing in the sky. You don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. Having that description, like a lot of us have seen UFOs. Like, you know, I was in Chicago this past week. And if you've never been to Chicago on the 4th of July, every single family in Chicago is having their own large-scale fireworks display at all times for the entire week surrounding the holiday. So, you know, I saw a lot of UFOs. There were a lot of like really weird things just flying through the sky randomly. You know, having said that, I think this is somewhere where most astronomers that I know break from sort of like the general like science interested public in that I cannot think of a single astronomer who thinks that they have seen an alien spaceship. And astronomers look at the sky a lot, like a lot. So, you know, sure, like maybe we wouldn't be able to tell. For me, like from a practical consideration, like I want to actually know. So if they're like skulking out there and they're stealthy and everything, I don't care unless they like give me something to study.
Right.
I mean, I do kind of care, but yeah.
So about earlier this year, the New York Times Pentagon correspondent Helene Cooper wrote, which what I thought was this just absolutely incredible story and led me to start screaming about it on my podcast, which is why the folks from Future Tense said, do you want to come host this event? which was, so for those of you who didn't read it, it was that she found essentially a a line item office in the DoD. I think it was funded to the tune of several hundreds of millions of dollars, which was in effect devoted to study the phenomenon that we're describing here of unidentified flying objects. And she interviewed the man who ran that office, who said, look, I can't tell you scientifically what the answer to this question is, but what I can tell you is that my colleagues and I have, with you know, either our own eyes or people that we've interviewed, including Navy pilots who had very compelling encounters with craft they couldn't understand, we have observed technology for which we do not have an explanation. That everything we know about engineering and aerodynamics and physics and aerospace technology, whatever this thing is, I can't tell you what that is. That shocks the hell out of me, right? And I mean, you listen to these testimonials and these are very rational people. These are pilots. These are people who know what flying objects are. They were not on drugs. They were not ill. And you know, we have no explanation for this thing that flew around F-15s and went up and down and suddenly it was gone. So I'm not asking you, what is it? But for people like you who are pondering these questions, when you see something that is that sort of compelling, right, that's strange and mysterious, then you find out that there are people literally in the Department of Government that build flying things and help build spacecraft that have spent hundreds of millions of dollars and have seen things they can't explain. What do you do with that?
Well, so first of all, different branches of the government build a lot of different things that fly, some of which we know about and some of which you don't.
Right.
And a lot of times the like shapes that are described for, you know, UFO sightings actually keep pretty good pace with whatever the most recent spy plane was that you usually don't find out until several decades later. I mean, I think about like, you know, us as astronomers, for example. So, you know, we're astronomers, we know a lot about the sky, et cetera. You know, a couple of years ago, the, you know, National Surveillance Office, the NSO, just was like, guys want two telescopes? Like two Hubbles that are designed to point at Earth. So we inherited, right, the like government surveillance, like spy telescopes, which are now being retrofitted and turned into awesome space missions that are pointed not at Earth, but out in space. So, you know, not everybody always knows what everybody else is doing.
But do you think, not that I don't like your answer, but I don't like your answer. but, I mean, this, I'll go back to this New York Times article. I mean, this pilot is freaking out when he is seeing this thing that is just doing things. I can't explain it. I mean, I cover the government. I cannot believe they could keep something like that secret.
No.
That doesn't mean it came from space, but I just don't know that it came from Langley. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know too, right? Because there's also, there's an element of human interpretation of images is really complicated. Like as an astronomer, I can tell you, like I work in a planetarium, people come in and tell me things that they saw all the time. And they do actually, and they'll be like, when I was five, I saw, and then they'll describe something that they saw when they were five. They are now 45. And I'm like, I have no idea what you saw. I wasn't born yet. And that could be a lot of things, right? So, you know, there are certain challenges to understanding what's in the sky first and foremost. And this is something that you can actually check out yourself the next time you see a full moon on the horizon, is that it is extremely difficult to judge distance and size in the sky, which sets your expectations for how rapidly something can move and how it can move. So a thing that happens is sometimes when people send up, I don't know what you call them, they're those lanterns that have like a little fire, they're like paper lanterns that have like a little fire thing. Those are a huge source of UFO sightings.
I saw one once and was freaking out, not knowing
because it's a light that's in the sky, it is impossible to judge how far away it is, and it moves with the breeze, right? So it does all these like unpredictable motions. And so, you know, the next time that the moon is on the horizon, or maybe you've seen this in the past, the moon looks huge, right? But, you know, go like that, measure how big it is, and then later that night, go out and measure it again. It's actually the same. It's that you, when you see it on the horizon, have comparison with things like trees and buildings, and your brain is actually interpreting how big that moon is relative to something that you have an idea of what size it is. And then when it's up overhead, you have nothing like that to compare it with. And so this is you know, just an example of the many ways in which it can be difficult to judge what it is you're seeing in the sky when you have no idea like how far away it is, how big it is, et cetera.
So when we started this conversation, I said I was 80-20. And I was actually leaning 80-20 against because I was very worried about the implications of actively trying to reach out for fear of what we might provoke. And I think I took the Stephen Hawking view of things. I think I'm kind of 50-50 after this, though. I fall on the side of hoping they contact us first, though. I so desperately want that to happen. And when they do, I hope that you guys are there telling us how to talk to them.
We also hope that.
I'm going to try and make sure, but I'm with you. Thank you so much. This is so much fun. Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Future Tense for letting us broadcast the event. If you haven't yet, give us a 5-star review and a rating wherever you find us and share us with your friends and followers on social media, especially those terrible non-believers. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.